and Alonzo Walling met her at the train. That night plot unfolded, poor Pearl lost her life. Scott and Alonzo both hung for that crime. Ghoulish, bone-chilling greetings, my friends. The music is courtesy of the amazing Bobby Mackey, and I, of course, am your host, Tessa Morrow. Today, as I record this, it is Father's Day, so just before I start anything else, I want to wish every single one of you fathers a very happy Father's Day. Thanks so much for stopping by and making Paranormal Prowlers Podcast part of your morning, day, evening, night, graveyard shift. Whenever you listen and wherever you are listening from on top of a mountain to an isolated island, from desolate desert to the biggest of cities, and yeah, you guessed it, everything in between, it is absolutely appreciated. This week's special city shoutouts go to Windsor, Colorado, Aberdeen, Maryland, Chelsea, England, Elk Grove, California, Peoria, Arizona, and Groningen, Netherlands. Today we are diving into part two of my Reign of Horror Vampire Serial Killers. Part one was released in January, and it is episode 303 titled Reign of Horror, a look into the lives and deaths of vampire serial killers Peter Curtin and Fritz Harman. You know, there are monsters in this world that take the shape of human form, and sadly, looks can be extremely deceiving. They could be good-looking law students who the women flock over, like Ted Bundy. They could be the person who dresses up as a clown and visits children's hospitals and makes sick children feel good, if only for a moment, like John Wayne Gacy. They could be deeply involved in the church community with a wife and children, like Dennis Rader. It could be the nurse administering more than just your ordinary dose of medicine, like Jane Topham. It could happen in your community. It could be your neighbor, your friend, somebody extremely close to you, and you might not even have a single freaking clue about it. Warning, this episode contains content that includes rape, the murder of children, the torturing of women, children, and animals, necrophilia, and other disturbing details about some of the murder cases. And before some of the really graphic stuff, I will warn you guys ahead of time, just in case you don't want to listen to it and you could skip ahead. While in part one, I talked about two serial killers, in part two today, I will be talking about three demented individuals. First up, Richard Chase. Better known as the Vampire of Sacramento, or Dracula, due to his absolute fascination with blood. Now, as a young boy, Richard grew up with a pretty bad, unstable upbringing. His father, he was rather abusive. Chase, he bore signs of a budding serial killer from a very young age. He was an arsonist. He was a prolific bedwetter. And he took pleasure in torturing and killing animals. Later on in life, Richard would also be diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. There was one extremely disturbing incident where Richard had killed a rabbit and actually injected himself with the rabbit's blood. Now, this is extremely disgusting and disturbing and demented, the triple D's, and it made him very sick. Like, he was severely sick after this incident. Well, after the killing of Thumper, he would be institutionalized, and this is back in 1975. Being confined did not stop his sadistic ways, though. He continued to hurt animals in confinement. He would kill several birds, and he would, of course, drink his feathery victims' blood. His reason behind this was that he was very sick, and drinking blood from others could be the remedy that he needed to get him better. Who needs the hospital? Who needs medicine? I've got blood. He thought that would kick the illness right in the ass. Don't know if he was just trying to plead insanity or if he sincerely believed this to be true. Either way, not cool. Now, he's not in the institute for very long, and in mid-1977, police find Chase in Lake Tahoe, and they come upon quite a rather eerie and disturbing sight. Richard Chase, he is covered in blood. It's like he freaking bathed in the stuff. Not only that, but in the back of his truck was a bucket which contained blood and a liver. Richard claimed that the blood was his and that the liver was from a cow. And surprisingly enough, the authorities actually believe him. Yeah, they actually believed him. That's just shocking to me. And they let him go. Utterly unbelievable. So, warning, it's about to get just a tad bit graphic. Murderpedia.com goes into disturbing detail, and I quote, "As an adult, Chase moved back in with his mother, where he began to accuse her of attempting to murder him via poison. Chase's father purchased an apartment for him and forced him to move out of the house. Alone in his new apartment, Chase began to capture, kill, and disembowel various animals, which he would then devour raw. He then began to put the entrails of the animals he had killed into a blender in order to make smoothies. Chase reasoned that by drinking these smoothies, he was preventing his heart from shrinking. He feared that if it shrank too much, that it would disappear, and then he would die. One day in 1977, Chase rang his mother's doorbell, greeted her by thrusting a dead cat in her face. He then threw the cat to the ground, knelt down, ripped its stomach open with his bare hands, stuck his hands inside the cat, smearing its blood all over of his face while screaming at his mother. His mother calmly returned inside the house. She did not report the incident to anyone. On August 3, 1977, Nevada State Police discovered Chase's Ford Ranchero lodged in a sand drift near Pyramid Lake, Nevada. Inside were two rifles, a pile of clothing, a bucket full of blood, and a cow's liver. The officers tracked down Chase, who was naked and screaming in the sand, soaked from head to toe in blood. When questioned, he claimed that the blood was his own and that it had leaked out of him through his flesh. Unquote. I mean, okay, what the bloody hell? Am I the only one absolutely disturbed by the mother's actions? If this is not a cry for help by a sick, demented, tortured individual, I don't know what is. His mother ignored it? She closed the door in his face and did not do anything about it? Come on! And this is after he was institutionalized. Call the police. If you're afraid, which I wouldn't blame her, I would be afraid too, call the authorities. That's what they're there for. They'll help you. I mean, if anything, he would get charges for animal abuse. That's better than nothing. You see a kid screaming bloody murder. You're at your favorite restaurant. Maybe you're at the grocery store. You're just enjoying yourself. You're shopping. You're eating. You're doing whatever. And you hear this kid scream, scream, scream. Mom, dad, they're not doing anything about it. They don't care. Basically, they're just getting away with throwing a tantrum in public. Well, this is so much worse because this tantrum includes death and he is literally getting away with it. And it was just not animals that he's hurting. Of course, that's why he's a serial killer. Chase would later share with the authorities that he would search for homes in neighborhoods with unlocked doors. No home in Sacramento was safe. In his schizophrenic, riddled, and plagued mind, he thought that an unlocked door meant, hey, we're welcoming you into our humble abode. Come on in, partner. Take your shoes off at the door. Where a locked door was saying, hands off. We are off limits. Go away, you are not wanted here. Shoo, shoo. In the late 1970s, at the same time he is killing animals and drinking their blood, he kills at least six people. The number may be higher, but we have six confirmed deaths connected to this man. Monster. Beast. Whatever you want to call him. Vampire. He would claim his very first known victim, human that is, as we know he had been murdering animals almost his entire life, on the 29th day of December in 1977. Ambrose Griffin was a very well-liked man in the community. He was a devoted husband, a loving father, the best dad that his two children could ever have dreamed of having. He's killed in a drive-by shooting. Well, 2 days earlier in the same neighborhood where Ambrose breathed his last breath, a woman's home is shot up. Now, thankfully, she was not injured during this ever-so-terrifying incident. But it was determined that the slug that was found in the unidentified woman's home and the one that took Ambrose Griffin's life came from one and the same rifle. Again, folks, things are going to get graphic. 3 weeks later, on January 21st of 1978, Richard Chase would commit his second murder. A young pregnant woman named Teresa Wallen was home alone. Her husband, he was at work. She goes outside to take something out to her trash can. Chase, seeing that the door is open, and, you know, his demented mind, of course, is saying, hey, this is an invitation to enter this unlocked home. He shoots her 3 times. After she's killed, he rapes the body. And he begins to dissect her body. He even bathes in her blood. And, you know, if this isn't truly horrific enough, which you better believe your ass it is, he proceeds to go outside, find some dog poop, brings it back into the house, and he shoves it down this woman's throat. This is truly disturbing and barbaric behavior. The same rifle is used in this case as well. And the graphic details, they continue to pour on in, guys, as 1 week later, January 27th, he enters the home of a young divorcee named Evelyn Miroth. She's not home alone, though. She was babysitting her little nephew, who at the time was 2 months shy of being 2 years old, her 6-year-old son, and a good friend of hers named Dan, who lived next door, was also there. Dan was a gentleman who, sadly at the time, was battling a brain tumor. Dan was helping out, watching the 2 children as Evelyn was in the shower. Chase casually enters the home as if he would be going into a friend's home and immediately shoots Dan 2 times in the head, killing him instantly. Evelyn's 6-year-old son begins to run towards his mother's location when he too is gunned down, his young life snuffed away by a heinous creature. He then proceeds to murder Evelyn and the 22-month-old baby as well. Not only did he use his go-to weapon, his rifle, but he also used several knives in this massacre. He would rape and sodomize Evelyn's corpse many, many times. So he butchers the victims, eating body parts, drinking blood as if it were wine or your favorite beer. He decapitates the baby, partially eating the brain. I mean, if Hollywood created a movie about this, many would say, at least a long time ago, right? Because today it's like, ooh, but...
Oh God, nobody can be that cruel.
But this is terrifyingly real stuff. The stuff that nightmares are made out of. I mean, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. This man is clearly a sick individual. It doesn't matter if you're a man, a woman, a child, an infant. Nobody is safe. Nobody or nothing is safe. He indeed had mental issues. He really should have been in an institution for the rest of his life. Throw a straitjacket on him, put him in a padded room, and bye-bye. He would throw many motives and excuses to the authorities and investigators. He blamed the Italians. It was the damn Italians that were framing me. Oh, that poor guy. And at some point, he blames the mafia. He also threw the authorities, hey, UFOs and aliens were responsible. Keep an eye out for those bad boys.
We need a bolo out on a spaceship, please.
When asked why he cannibalized and drank the blood of the victims, he claimed it was because he was hungry. It's like, he answered it just so simply, as if like, hey, what color is the sky? What color is that flower? Yeah, I was just hungry, whatever. Well, Richard Chase would spend the rest of his life in San Quentin. His fellow inmates, who, let's face it, themselves were no innocent lambs, he imitated the hell out of these guys. Some were frightened of him, and some would even try to convince him, just kill yourself, just take your life. A day after Christmas in 1980, Richard Chase, the vampire of Sacramento, is found dead in his jail cell. The cause of death, an overdose on pills that he had been hiding. Next up in my vampire serial killer list is Polish serial killer Joachim Niechala. And it's spelled Joachim, so you might hear me saying Joachim, but watching some videos, it was pronounced differently, so don't know. Tessa Bircher names here. Here we go. He's better known as the Vampire of Bytom, also known as Frankenstein. He was married and a father of two. He worked as a miner, and his side gig? Yeah, killing women. He has 5 confirmed deaths under his belt. Joaquim's first known murder takes place November of 1975 when he takes the life of Elisabetta Mukuloa, and I quote executedtoday.com, quote, he inherited his appellation from a different Silesian mass murderer, Zdzisław Marchwicki, the vampire of Zagliby. Again, sorry, butcherer of names, with whom he eerily shared a victim. Mirosława Sarnowska, who survived an attack by the earlier vampire and gave crucial evidence against him, would become Joaquim's third homicide. Unquote. Okay, so seriously, how heartbreaking is that? This poor, poor woman is first terrorized by the vampire of Zagliby, amazingly survives the attack, even testifying against the monster, handing over evidence, only to be murdered by yet another vampire serial killer later on. I cannot even begin to imagine the terror she must have gone through in both cases, what she went through physically and mentally, and the heartbreak that her family must have endured. Like, they must have been, like, in relief, like, oh my God, she's safe, she beat this, and then just to lose her in an equally horrible way. Just truly heartbreaking, for sure. Now, when it comes to this specific victim, I found more information on truecrimesarchives.blog. Quote, a chilling connection links Sarnowska's case to another infamous serial killer, the vampire of Zagliby. While details are limited, available information suggests that she was a victim of an earlier assault by Marchwicki. She survived that attack only to later perish at the hands of Nychala. This disturbing coincidence highlights the terrifying reality of multiple serial killers operating within the same region and targeting similar victims. The shared victim underscores the need for a thorough investigation into potential links between serial killers, particularly when operating in close geographical proximity and exhibiting similar modus operandi. The overlapping timelines and geographic locations raise questions about the possibility of missed connections during the initial investigations into both killers' crimes. This intersection of their predatory behaviors creates a complex and disturbing case study and criminal psychology. It raises questions about the effectiveness of law enforcement procedures during that era and difficulties in connecting seemingly disparate cases, especially when the initial attacks did not result in fatalities. The survival of Sarnowska in one instance, and her subsequent demise at the hands of another perpetrator emphasizes the vulnerability of potential victims and the devastating consequences of failing to effectively link seemingly unrelated events. The shared victim serves as a grim reminder of the chilling impact of unchecked serial offending and the need for improved investigative techniques and interagency cooperation. Further research is necessary to fully understand the nature of the connection between Marchwicki's assault and Nychala's ultimate act against Sarnowska. Unquote. Now, going off topic for a moment, the vampire who did not succeed in killing her, he was convicted of murdering 14 women along with another group of people. So it was just like a group of these men just like taking lives. And he would attack several others. And he was executed by hanging along with his own brother in 1977. Not much can really be found about Joaquim. I quote the same article I was just reading from executedtoday.com. Quote, in May 1982, Joaquim reported the death of his 17-year-old sister-in-law in a fall in the woods. Examination of the body told a more sinister tale. She'd been done in by a blunt force near the top of the skull, and improbable for a mere accidental fall, and she had recent intercourse. Nychala was dramatically arrested at the girl's funeral, eventually coping to his spree and comforting himself with the hopes of a better afterlife, of pop culture notoriety. He has thus far somewhat maintained his recognizable infamy in a Poland that no longer produces death sentences, unquote. Other murders of his include the axe killing of a woman named Teresa Rimes. He killed her October 30th of 1976. Then, June 23rd of 1979, he murders Halina Sora. And on May 8th, 1982, he claims his final victim, Bogusława Luriga. So you see the last three here, it's just like 1976, 1979, 1982. He's definitely taking cooling off periods, but who the hell knows if he traveled and did more killings. The Vampire of Bytom is executed by hanging October 28th, 1985. And the final serial killer I'm going to talk about in part two of my vampire serial killers is Wayne Bowden, also known as the Vampire Rapist. This Canadian serial killer is linked to at least four murders, possibly more though. October 3rd of 1969, a woman named Shirley Audette is found dead in her downtown Montreal apartment. Immediately looking at her body, the authorities knew they had a murder on their hands. Little did they know, the culprit, the murderer, he was just getting started. This poor woman was raped, strangled, and brutally attacked. It looked like she was bitten by a ravenous animal, bite marks on her breasts. Investigators looked into a boyfriend of hers, but he had a great alibi. He was at work, and people were able to back that up. And apparently she would spend time outside her apartment sitting there, just taking in the fresh air, and sadly, her neighbor, a blooming psychopathic serial killer, knew her habits and he took advantage of that, and she would pay with her life. November 23rd of 1969, a woman named Marielle Archambault ended her workday, unbeknownst to her, for the very last time. She leaves the store she's working at, and witnesses claim to have seen her leaving with a man who she had called Bill. She seemed happy, she was in good spirits, so why would anybody think anything of it? This is the last time she would be seen alive. Now, when she's a no-show the following morning at work, it's unlike her, it's out of character. That's not Marielle. If she were sick or unable to come into work because of something else, she would have let them know. She would have communicated with them. So her fellow coworkers and employer, they sound the alarm bell, thank God. And her concerned boss actually goes over to her apartment, reaches out to the landlord, and together they would enter the woman's apartment, and what they found, I'm sure, would stay with them and haunt them for the rest of their lives. Her lifeless body is on the couch in plain view, and like the murder victim before her, Shirley Audette, it's very obvious that she met a grisly end. Her bra and pantyhose were noticeably torn, her breasts also shown bite marks on them, and evidence would show that she was indeed raped. In her apartment, they found a crumpled up photo of Marielle and a man. When the picture was shown to her coworkers, they said, "Hey, that's the man, that's Bill. You know, we saw her with him last night." Later, it would come out that the mystery man in the photo was not her killer, but her father, who had died earlier on. Why was it crumbled up and discarded? Perhaps the killer did this because maybe the killer and the father looked pretty similar. On January 17th of 1970, a gentleman named Brian heads over to his girlfriend Jean Way's apartment in Montreal. They had a date night planned, and Brian arrives and he's ready to enjoy the night out on the town with his favorite gal, but he's confused when she does not answer the door.
"Jean, are you there?"
They had planned a certain time, and yet he's here and she's not. Where is Jean Way? This was before every single person and their child and grandma and great-grandma and grandpa had a cell phone. He couldn't just call her up from the door and see what the hell was going on. So he leaves thinking, okay, well, maybe she needed more time, or maybe she had to go run a quick errand or something else. When he comes back and she does not answer his knocks once more, he tries the door and he finds that it is unlocked. He walks in, he searches her home, and he sadly would find her body in her bedroom. Now, while there's obviously a similarity to these three murders, Janeway's death differentiates itself from Shirley and Marielle, as her breasts were not viciously bitten, like the other two. But what was also different in this case was that somebody had knocked on the door, possibly interrupting the attack and murder. Maybe it frightened the killer, who thought, well, geez-a-loo, whoever is at the door is probably going to come back. I better hit the bricks. So in a matter of just a few short months, Montreal has seen three beautiful young women raped and viciously murdered, two of them with their breasts being bitten. The public was terrified, and rightfully so. Who would be next? Me? You? You over there? You? Move over. You? But they breathe a sigh of relief, I imagine, when no murders like this occur for almost an entire year and a half. Maybe the killer was arrested for something else. Perhaps he moved away, or fingers crossed, what if he died? But their comfort levels would be tested and challenged once more, this time not in Montreal, but in Calgary. May 18, 1971, Calgary, Alberta, a woman named Elizabeth Ann Porteous, who was a high school teacher, did not arrive to school one day, which was very out of character for her. Concerned, her landlord was called by co-workers, who asked the landlord to please go check on her. Well, the discovery we all know too well. Her apartment showed signs that someone who shouldn't have been there was there. It was ransacked. Things were scattered about like a struggle took place. Her body, like the others, is found in her bedroom. She had been raped. She was strangled. And the all-too-terrifying signature mark, the horrific bite marks on the breasts. Now, underneath Elizabeth's body was an excruciatingly vital clue that was left behind by her killer, a broken cufflink. Yeah. Now, during this investigation, while talking to her coworkers and other people in her life, it was mentioned by some that she was seen with a man who she had called Bill, who drove a blue Mercedes-Benz, which had a bull decal on the back of the vehicle. I mean, this is fantastic. This is the second time that Bill is mentioned, okay? And now we have a car, and not only that, not only is it a blue Mercedes-Benz, but it has a decal of a bull on the back. That's perfect. That's beautiful. That's the evidence that the police need. So, of course, law enforcement, they have a bolo out for this blue Mercedes with a bull decal on the back. And the very next day, yes, just one day after Elizabeth's murder, two police officers find the car. And believe it or not, it's a stone's throw away from the murder scene. So they wait to see who approaches the vehicle, and about a half hour later, a very good-looking man, I mean this guy, he used to be a model, he eventually walks up to the car. Is it Bill? Bill was an alias that Wayne Bowden liked to use, and he was arrested, and he shares with authorities that he had been dating the victim and was with her the night before. There's no denying it. He also admits that prior to living in Calgary, that he had lived in Montreal and had just moved here recently. Remember, the other three murders? Montreal, baby. He also says that the cufflink found under the woman's body was, yeah, that's mine, sure. But he promises to the highest of heavens that his girlfriend was alive, healthy, and happy when he left her last night. Wayne Bowden's case was different than the others, as he had this pure, utter obsession with biting his victim's breasts. I'm unsure if they were alive during this time, but I pray to God that they were not. The authorities get in touch with a gentleman who was an orthodontist in the area named Gordon Swan. His goal was to try and help prove that the bite marks left on Elizabeth Ann came from Wayne Bowden. I mean, he already admitted to being with her before her death, making him the last person to be with her before she died. Wiki goes into more detail, and I quote, "There was nothing in Canadian literature on forensic odontology at the time. Swan wrote to the FBI in the United States, hoping for any information on the matter. Swan received a reply from FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, who directed him to England, where he met a man who had dealt with 20 or 30 cases regarding bite marks. Swan was able to get the information he needed, and based on a cast made of Bowden's teeth, he managed to demonstrate 29 points of similarity between the bite marks on Portis's body and Bowden's teeth. The evidence provided by Gordon Swan was sufficient for the jury of Bowden's trial to find him guilty for the murder of Elizabeth Ann Porteous, and subsequently sentenced to life imprisonment. Bowden was the first murderer to be convicted in North America based on odontological evidence. Unquote. So this serial killer, mind you, had two separate murder trials. The one in Calgary, where he took the final victim's life, and the one in Montreal, where he savagely snubbed the lives of his first three victims. He would get four life sentences. Yes, this monster would never see the light of day as a free man ever again. Or would he? So, you would think that that would be the end of the story, right? For Wayne Bowden? Okay, four life sentences, you're out of here. But unfortunately, a few years into his sentences, he manages to escape. Now, you would think this is something that Hollywood would make up. How is it possible that this man, a serial killer and a rapist, has a day pass, a free card?
What?
How is it even a possibility that a fucking serial killer, excuse my language, and a rapist is able to get a day pass? It's just beyond me. But anyways, besides having a day pass, which again, whew, wow, way over the head there, the serial killer with an addiction of biting women's breasts and murdering them was approved for, get this, a credit card by a very well-known credit card company. Armed with his day pass and his little credit card, swipey swipey, he was ready to enjoy his day. Him and his social worker are enjoying lunch at a Chinese restaurant because, hey, it beats prison food, right? When nature, supposedly calls, I gotta go pee. He excuses himself to use the restroom. Why, his social worker, or better yet, an armed guard, escort him into the bathroom and hold his hands and watch his every single damn move is beyond me. Wayne Bowden, also known as Bill, also known as the vampire rapist, had the type of freedom that most serial killers and other offenders could only dream of having. He manages to escape, and he's a free man for several days. He's recaptured, and he spends the rest of his life in Kingston Penitentiary. That is until he went to the hospital, and he was there for 6 weeks before succumbing to skin cancer, March of 2006. So, remember everybody, while walking down the street, that ordinary-looking person walking past you could be a monster in disguise as they roam the earth freely. For now. Did you enjoy this week's episode? Listen to the others, they're all phenomenal. Haven't heard every single one yet? No need to lose sleep over it, really. You could binge listen to your heart's fright and delight. Just hit up any of those podcast platforms, such as Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Cast, Podcast Republic, Overcast. Basically, wherever you hear your other spooky podcasts, you'll probably find Paranormal Prowlers podcast lurking in the background. Thanks, everyone, and
I will see you next week.